Great Lives is a download from Radio 4. We hope you enjoy what you're about to hear. In 1899, the Madras Standard printed the following. If India were a republic and the republic had a right to elect its own president, the man who, by the unanimous voice of his countrymen, would have been elected its uncrowned king is Dadabhai Nauroji. No Indian is more loved, more honoured, more esteemed throughout the length and breadth of India than he. That's quite a tribute. The man choosing Dadabhai Nauroji is chef and restaurateur Cyrus Todivala, owner of Cafe Spice Namaste in London. He's cooked for presidents and royalty, including Her Majesty the Queen on her Diamond Jubilee tour, but he's perhaps best known for his TV appearances on shows such as Saturday Kitchen and as one half of the incredible Spice Men. Cyrus, why have you picked Dadabhai Nauroji?
Dadabhai Nauroji stood out for us when I was a child. Of course, everybody spoke about the man. Now in India, people would know less of him, unfortunately. But he was the person who Mahatma Gandhi once called the father of the nation. So Dadabhai Nauroji was known to have been the mentor for Mahatma Gandhi while he was studying over here. And he influenced in years to come people like Nelson Mandela, etc. as well. So Dadabhai Nauroji was a huge character. He broke the barrier of the first ever non-British member of parliament to be elected into parliament. He broke that barrier. He also, of course, was known for his outstanding approach on various topics that he stood firm on, including women's rights at the time when women did not have equal rights or did not come into public eye as being equal to men. And he actually was one of the first advocates of equality amongst women.
And I guess what makes him so extraordinary is how early he did this. We're talking about the end of the 19th century.
We are talking about the end of the 19th century. So as in that era, he would have been a very remarkable individual. And today, of course, there's a street named after him. So I make it a point, if I'm going to North London, I go past Nauroji Street just to feel proud of another fellow Parsi.
Next time, I've seen the street and I never knew what the name referred to.
Well, fellow Parsi, so you always feel proud of it.
Yes, now you say he was a fellow Parsi, as you are.
Yeah.
That's significant, is it?
It is significant because we are few and far between as the Zoroastrian community. Whether we look at it from our starting point, which was the Persia of the old or Iran of today, going to a sizable community in India and now dwindling globally. So Parsis would stand out because we are few and far between, for one. Number two is that it just has a little beacon there. So if individual Parsis, if we were 0.001% of India's population, and we achieved 90% of the growth for India within that tiny fraction of a community, it is something for someone like me to aspire to achieve greater things in life.
Now, I want to pursue that, and I want to pursue it with our expert, Zara Banu Gifford, who's studied and written about Dadabhai Nauroji and who herself stood for Parliament, which I believe is when you first became aware of his life, and to his life in a moment. But just tell me a little about the Parsis, or Zoroastrianism, or sun worship, people used to call it. What is this religion?
It's the oldest monotheism in the world. Our prophet is Zoroaster, and he lived in Iran. We don't know when, but certainly a minimum of 2,000 years before Christ. And he was a revolutionary. To me, he was a genius. He came forward with the idea that everybody, men and women, had a conscience and they had to decide between good and evil. So the religion is very much based on good and evil. And it's very simple. It's you have to have good thoughts, good words and good deeds.
Now, Zara Banu, tell us a bit about your co-religionist, Dadabhai Nauroji. How did you first become aware of his life?
Well, in 1982, I got elected as a councillor in Harrow, and I hadn't got the faintest idea who Dadabhai was. I'd studied history. That was my speciality. It was only when I went to an Asian women's meeting and I heard Dr. Kusum Vadgama talk about Dadabhai that I realised how many parallels there were in our lives. And I was just fascinated. I just fell in love with him. And I decided I was going to really research his life and find out more about him. So it was by chance.
Very much by chance. There is a green plaque in Finsbury Town Hall commemorating him, but I think it's fair to say that he is not a well-known figure.
Absolutely not, and that only happened after we celebrated his centenary in 1992, which Dr. Badgama and myself co-chaired, and we managed to get a portrait up.
The centenary of his election.
Yes, of his election.
Yes, yeah.
So there was 100 years, and we managed to get a portrait of him up in Parliament. And just recently, we were with 25 Asian graduates going around Parliament, and the official guide hadn't got the faintest idea who he was or the portrait was up in Parliament. I consider it was the best kept secret in British political life. To me, he was a polymath. He was a Renaissance man. I don't know any politician today that would be an economist, would be an academic, would be an ethical businessman, would be a social reformer, would take on real problems of the day and do it all with such style. And I think more for me was that he inspired me. And then I looked at all the people that he inspired, and he was so influential. He was there at the right moment of history. He influenced Jinnah, and Jinnah went on to become the founder of Pakistan. Jinnah worked with him on his campaign. He influenced Gandhi, as we said. Gandhi called him my dada. And he worked with Gandhi when he was in South Africa to deal with the racism in South Africa. He influenced the second Asian member of parliament, Sabah Negri, who was a Tory in 1895. And he worked with Dadabhai, and Dadabhai was so magnanimous that he helped him in his campaign. He didn't say, you're a Tory and I won't help you. He understood the importance of influencing people.
Which I want to come on to, but first I'd like to ask you, Cyrus, you say he was very well known in your generation. Is he still well known in India today, or is he being forgotten?
I think he's not as well known as it was during our time, because when we were in school, the independence was only a few years earlier. Mm. And the great people who influenced the independence of India or started the Quit India movement, and those that did it with a bit of style and panache, one of them, of course, being Dadabhai Nauroji, because he was actually the founder of a peaceful aggression. Mm. No bloodshed, no aggression, and a very peaceful way of protest. Mm. So he initiated that because he thought that violence would help nothing. And I think in our days, we understood it better. And of course, in nowadays, of course, his stamp was everywhere. So you bought a postage stamp and Dadabhai Nauroji was on the stamp. And today's children might forget that because it's 70 years since independence.
Before we look at his political work and his achievements, I'd like to get a little bit of an idea of Dadabhai's background. Where did he come from? What was his family upbringing?
Well, he was born into a poor priestly class, and his father died when he was 4 years old.
So poor but educated?
No, not educated at all.
His really?
His mother was illiterate, and she brought him up, and he said that he owed everything to his mother.
When you say a priestly class, what do you mean there?
His father was a Zoroastrian priest, mm. And Zoroastrian priests in those days were poor. Mm. They didn't have status, but they kept the religion going, and they kept the morality of the religion going. And so I think all his feminism and all his love of women came from his devotion to his mother. I have a sort of feeling that when a woman brings up a child and there's no other child and there's no husband, she really does concentrate on her child. And I think it makes a difference.
He was a studious boy.
Very studious. He was a scholarship boy. It was through scholarships that he went to Elphiston College. Really, his academic career started from that. Mm. Unfortunately, he couldn't find the money to become a scholar in Britain, because in those days, anybody who wanted to succeed usually came to Britain to study law, and he couldn't find the money. So he stayed in India and made history by becoming the first maths professor who was an Indian. So that was the beginning of his firsts.
And he became interested in, you wouldn't necessarily call it politics, but society and social reform very early, even when he was at school.
Oh, very early. I mean, he started teaching girls in their homes because parents wouldn't allow girls to go to school. And he started campaigning. He started a magazine called The Truth Teller. And he was just very courageous and, I think, honest. Mm. I think he was just noble and simple. He was a simple person, And he knew what he had to do in life.
But a maverick.
Yes.
In every form of it. You see, in a soft kind of way, which is what is most amazing about this individual. Because aggression was not his key. It was persuasion that got him to where he got him finally.
Are you a bit of a maverick, Cyrus? What do you say?
Well, I get myself into trouble, though. I'm not like him. I'm a little bit more volatile. I could be called a maverick in some respects, yes, because I did a few things when I came to this country because I found them not right or whatever it was. But that's, I think, in our Parsi blood.
Mm.
It exists, whether we like it or not. We Parsis have a certain streak of rebellion within us. And we also have a certain streak of creativity and pioneering attitude, which is somewhere genetic. And it disappoints me when a lot of Parsis go down the professional route and don't go down routes of, you know, helping others along the way by going into business or whatever else it is.
So, mind you, you've been successful down that route. Dadabai was not. He came to Britain to start a business. Is that right?
Yes.
Yes.
It was Karma and Company. It was the first Indian business in Britain, and it dealt with cotton in Liverpool and also with opium. And
which was a legal drug in those days.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's how the empire made a lot of money. And Dadabhai was a man of great morality. He realised that the Indians were party to producing opium and having it dumped on China for money. And he only lasted as an ethical businessman for 3 years. He objected to that. And he had the foresight to realise that it would destroy a culture, which it did. It destroyed Chinese culture. And he would have nothing to do with it. He'd also have nothing to do with alcohol, which Cyrus might be very upset about.
No.
I don't think he drank toddy at all.
Well, he wouldn't have, because he grew up in Bombay, he may not have had the opportunity to drink toddy,
probably.
I'd like to form in my mind a picture of this still quite young man. He has come to Britain to start a business. The business didn't go particularly well. What sort of a man was he? Was he tall? Was he short? Was he light-skinned, dark-skinned, fat, thin? What sort of a man was this?
I think he was medium height. He was very fair-skinned.
Hmm.
Yes, he
because
was fair skin.
Some of the portraits you always see of him are very brown.
No, he was fair. And I think the priestly class, Zoroastrian priestly class, are much fairer than most Zoroastrians because they sit in front of the fire, which is always burnt with sandalwood, and they always say that that makes the skin beautiful.
And his personal life, did he marry?
What happened in those days was that he was betrothed to Gulbai, who was 7, and he was 11. And then when they came of age at 16, he married her. And it was not a happy marriage. She wasn't interested in education. She wasn't interested in his political life. And he was told by many people to divorce her, but he never divorced Gulbai. But he did campaign against child marriages in the same way as Gandhi did. He thought it was wrong.
Do we know, Cyrus, what put in his mind the seeds of the idea that he would stand for Parliament? It was an absolutely extraordinary idea at the time.
It was a very extraordinary idea, and I think the seeds were put because of discrepancies within how Indian businesses were treated at that time by the Crown and the East India Company. And there was no way of any kind of protest against wrongdoings by the East India Company in India. And he is one of the pioneers who set the pace going of directly opposing certain things that happened. And which, of course, I think the platform was better for him when he was in Parliament. So he could bring certain things to light that were the wrongdoings of the East India Company, perhaps the opium trade, perhaps other things. And these were, there was no way in which they could protest. Being in Parliament gave him that platform to actually start the work.
Absolutely. But Zabanu, I'm curious, I'm a bit incredulous how this coffee-skinned man in Victorian England, with all its cultural attitudes towards race, persuaded a party, the Liberal Party, whose priority must have been to field a candidate with the best chance of winning, to select him as their candidate.
Well, the selection is a blockbuster story.
Mm.
It wasn't nice. And there was a lot of deception, a lot of double dealing. And it was only right at the very, very end that Dadabhai actually had the seat to stand. And he had people standing against him, even though he'd been chosen by the selection panel. But he was just so steadfast and he was so persevering. He was determined that he would be the voice of 250 million people in India, which was four-fifths of the empire that had no say in the mother of parliaments. And he was actually the right person because nothing put him off. He wasn't trivial. He was so committed to an ideal of representation. And even when he was elected in Finsbury Central in 1892...
His second attempt.
With five votes, because people couldn't pronounce his name, they called him Mr. Narrow Majority. He still had to go to court because the Conservative candidate said that he'd bribed the electorate. So it was not easy.
His friend, George Birdwood, wrote to him urging him to give up the whole idea and withdraw from that first election. And Dadabhai replied, "When I undertook this arduous contest, I did it with my eyes open. Though this constituency is evidently a very difficult one, it is not so utterly hopeless. Be that as it may, I have entered the lists and I am bound in honour to fight it out."
Mm. Perfect. Mm. Perfect attitude. And again, like Parsi, stubborn as a mule.
Yes.
Stubborn as a mule. A thought sticks in the mind. It is very rare that it'll go off very easily.
Did he suffer a lot of racism, would you say, even having been elected? Was it plain sailing for him?
I would doubt very much if there was plain sailing for him.
After he got elected, St. Stephen's Review wrote, "Central Finsbury should be ashamed of itself at having publicly confessed there was not an Englishman, a Scotsman, a Welshman, or even an Irishman."
Even an Irishman.
"As worthy of their votes as this fire worshipper from Bombay." The press was prejudiced.
And he appeared in Punch magazine as Othello.
Yes.
And there was an extraordinary intervention from the Conservative Prime Minister, Lord Salisbury, during this election, wasn't there?
Yes, there was. He called Dadabhai a black man and said that he didn't think that the British public were ready to vote for a black man. It caused an outrage. And Dadabhai became a household name after that, not just in England, but all around the world.
It's important to be clear that at this stage in the evolution of his political ideas, he was not advocating secession or independence.
Absolutely not. He really believed in British justice and fair play. He thought the British were honourable. And I always had a little laugh when I used to research him because I thought how brilliantly the British did their PR. Here they were exploiting this extraordinary country, which was a jewel in the crown because of all the money they took from India. They knew what it was about. And yet the intelligentsia thought how very just and how very fair and how very honourable the British were. And Dadabhai did think so. He thought that if he came and he went and spoke to people and he researched as an economist, he was an economist, he researched a thesis, 700 pages, "Poverty and the Un-British Rule in India." He felt that people would understand, they would change their views. He thought the views that Indians were native and not worthy of education, they weren't worthy to join the civil service, they weren't worthy to be judges, would all be changed if he and other people explained to the British that this wasn't right.
You're listening to Great Lives on BBC Radio 4 with me, Matthew Paris. I'm joined today by Chef Cyrus Todivala to discuss the life of Dadabhai Nauroji with the help of our expert, Zarbanu Gifford. Let's talk a little about his time in Parliament, which was not very long, was it? Was he a success as a parliamentarian?
I think she's done the best research on that, maybe.
Zarbanu.
I don't know what a success in Parliament means. He certainly spoke on behalf of India. He spoke on behalf of his constituents. He was a radical. He fought for the votes for women. He fought for pensions for the elderly, the abolition of the House of Lords, which we're still discussing, home rule for Ireland, public housing. So he spoke on the great issues of the day. But of course, closest to his heart was representing the issues of India.
He was quite popular among women. Florence Nightingale was a fan of his. And Queen Victoria apparently was very annoyed when Lord Salisbury called him black.
Absolutely. Queen Victoria, I think, was a remarkable queen. she wasn't a racist, and she was absolutely, well, outraged, but she wasn't amused either by her Prime Minister, Lord Salisbury, calling Dadabai a black man.
Mm.
Florence Nightingale was a huge fan, as was Josephine Butler. And the suffragettes actually campaigned for Dadabai in Finsbury because they knew that he cared for womanhood and the suffrage. Also, he was very fortunate that he had the help of Keir Hardie. They were very, very close friends.
And
he took Keir Hardie to India after the election, and that's when the Labour Party was born. And again, he introduced Keir Hardie to the Tartars, who were instrumental in funding Beatrice and Sidney Webb to set up the Fabian Society. So many people in the Labour Party don't realise the initial funding of the party came from the Zoroastrian community.
Well, what a pity, Cyrus, that he didn't stay in Parliament longer. He lost his seat.
Lost
was
his
in 1895. Was that his fault? What happened?
Well, I think things must have moved on. I don't think it was his fault. Maybe there were other people who were being drummed up against him. And he would not have won the election simply because there must have been opposition being created. Because media would have created the opposition out of fear that this man could become more powerful if he was re-elected. And so who knows at the time what was going on in the areas around him. But I'm sure it must have been motivated to not allow somebody who's outside the actual empire.
A certain rejection, yes. Rejection.
Yes, I think that when he stood again in 1895... there was a Tory landslide, so a lot of Liberals lost their seat. He didn't stand in the 1900 because he wasn't well. And then when he stood again in 1905, he stood as a trade and Labour candidate. And, of course, that was just the beginning of the Labour Party, so he didn't have any chance of winning. So I think his parliamentary career really didn't carry on.
He returned to India after this, didn't
yes, he?
Yes,
he was quite ill. I mean, he died when he was 92, and he returned to India. And he, of course, was three times president of the Indian National Congress, which he helped found.
His career didn't end.
No, he was a politician both in India and in England. And before he'd come to England, he had been the Diwan for the Maharaja of Baroda, which means his prime minister. So he'd been involved in politics in India.
Great man, isn't it?
Mm.
I mean, just to think,
it
didn't stop here because he had another role to do. And his task was to now get Indians motivated to set up their own protest against British rule.
One can see his views changing. There's a letter he wrote in 1903. He said, "The Europeans plunder and take away the wealth. The capacity of the people becomes weakened and the taxation becomes oppressive. The government wants its pound of flesh for the European services, increasing the rate of taxation. The whole vicious circle goes on revolving. The fundamental cause, the cause of the whole mischief, is foreign domination. As long as that continues, there is no hope." This is a very different Dadabai from the young man.
Absolutely. I mean, I love him at this period of history because he's facing up to the facts and saying, we've had enough. This nonsense has got to stop. And I think he saw the famines in India in the 1900s. And I think he was shocked. I think he realised that his ideas of peaceful evolution and keeping the empire but reforming it wasn't working, and that they needed to be radical. They needed self-rule.
By the time he went back, his vision and his impressions and everything had changed, and he had actually sort of realised where the mistakes were.
He died in 1917, aged 92, as you say. It would be 30 years until India gained the independence that he had begun to speak so passionately about in his later years. Cyrus, next year is the 100th anniversary of Dadabai's death. How do you think he should be remembered? Better than he is remembered now, surely?
I think we should start a campaign of recognition back home in India.
Mm.
And I think India would do proud if they remembered this man as the man who actually sparked off the nationalist feeling amongst India that they need to take their own country and the destiny of their country belongs to them, that they need to fuel their own passion and unite to liberate India and to govern India into the future and make it a successful country. So he was actually the father who sparked all this. And I think the remembrance has to be a big affair, and he has to be commemorated in the right manner.
I suppose that, I wouldn't say critics, but those who would diminish his achievements would say that he was a kind of false dawn, that he came too early. Yes, he was a Member of Parliament for 3 years, but then he wasn't, and it took a very long time, for long after his death, for the ideas that he latched on too early to gain any ground, and that he wasn't really the man that made the difference.
What a question.
No. People who are pioneers are very important because they give other people inspiration. I mean, even today, I'm inspired by him. I feel often, you know, there's racism, there's this sort of attitude that we're doing you a favour. And I think, how would Dada Bai have reacted? He would have been noble. He would have taken it on. I think pioneers are very important because I think they set the scene, they show others that they can do it, and they put it on the agenda. Somebody has to put exploitation on the agenda, and then others can take it up. People have different roles to play in life. And I think that when we celebrate its death anniversary next year, I think he would not be interested in stamps or portraits of himself or anything like that. I think he would like to have a national scholarship in his name where young people would learn about politics and about good governance and about economics. And that, I think, would really mean something to him.
Well, for me, when you use the word, was he too early? No, he was not too early. He sowed the seeds in minds of great people like Gandhi. He sowed the seeds. So he was actually there at the right time to influence a young budding lawyer at the right time and to put the right kind of sensibility into an individual that eventually led the beliefs of Dada Bai Nauroji onto a bigger playing field. So in terms of his recognition, I think this is the perfect thing, and something to do with women perhaps, because we are still battling with inequalities throughout India as a subcontinent in terms of where in the pockets of rural India, women are still being treated very unfairly. And I think Dada Bai Nauroji, if he was alive today, would have been extremely upset with that.
My thanks to Cyrus Todivala for choosing the life of Dada Bai Nauroji and to Zerbanu Gifford for being our expert witness. Goodbye.
Thank you for downloading this programme from Radio 4. There are some 250 other editions of Great Lives available on the Radio 4 website.